This is Fresh Air. Broadway has inspired many songs, movies, and books. You can add to the list a new book called The Heart of the World by my guest Nick Cohn. It's a travel book in which the writer didn't travel very far, just down one street, Broadway, spanning the distance from downtown Manhattan to 59th Street. But in that one street, Cohn says he found the world. He started his career in England, where he wrote about rock and roll and the teen culture of the 60s. He's best known in America for his New York Magazine story about a Brooklyn disco, which was adapted into the film Saturday Night Fever. I asked Nick Cohn why he wanted to write a book about Broadway.
I grew up in Ireland, and in my sort of home background, in the town I grew up in, Broadway had a sort of mythic status, almost like Hollywood might have. Anybody who had any dreams of being a performer or adventuring in any way in life would dream of going to Broadway. And I think that every Irish person who ever arrived in New York, the first thing they'd do would be to go and stand on Times Square. That's what I did. I landed and I suppose 70 minutes later, there I was, looking up.
You and all the other pickpockets.
Well, in those days, there weren't so many.
Yeah. So people think of Broadway as being the place where all the Broadway theaters are, but Broadway's a pretty long street, and there's a lot else that's there. Give us a sense of the part of Broadway that you trekked across.
Well, I started at the Battery, right down at the foot of Broadway, and what makes Broadway unique is that there's hardly an area of human endeavor that isn't encompassed on this one boulevard. So you go through Wall Street, which is abuts Broadway, the City Hall, so you get politics, the law courts are just off. Now the sort of heart of the art world, Soho, that's also on Broadway. The sort of kids, clubs, discos, that's there. Boxing is there, magicians are there. And so by the time you've reached sort of 57th Street, there aren't many aspects of urban life that you haven't brushed across in one way or another.
Now, during the period when you were working on the book, you got a hotel room. Was it off-Broadway in Times Square?
Yes, it was one of the side streets in the 40s.
Was it a real flea bag?
No, it was. It had rules. And the rules included that anyone who used crack openly was ejected, and if you committed an act of violence against another guest, you got an extremely stiff warning.
Well, that's reassuring.
But it did say on the inside the door, there was a little sort of cycle-styled thing with the rates, and it said, discreet accommodations for the discerning few.
Mm-hmm.
So we were dealing with class here.
You're married, aren't you? And you have a home.
Yes, I am. Yes.
So how long did you live away from home for this?
Basically 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Your next door neighbor at the hotel was a girl who you described as a girl so beautiful it hurt. This was a girl who was really a boy who went by the name of Lush Life, but whose birth name was Geraldo Cruz.
That's right, yeah.
How did you become friends?
Well, the first night that I was there, she knocked on my door and wanted to borrow my eyeliner. And when she saw that I wasn't really the kind of person who had eyeliner, she forgave me for that and got into conversation. She was an extraordinarily open person without any kind of defenses or disguises. Everything was naked and open in her. She just started to talk, and she became sort of one of my two mentors on Broadway, took me around a great deal, and we became very close.
What kinds of places did she take you to that you otherwise might not have gone to?
Well, she took me to Sally's Hideaway, which is a transvestite bar near Times Square, but she also had friends, transvestite and also not transvestite, because she was very interested in theatre and opera, and she had dreams of a kind of cult stardom, I suppose, herself. I mean, she used to dress up as Madame Butterfly and sing along to opera records and so on.
Lush Life died before your book was published. What happened to her?
She had AIDS.
Oh.
And she hadn't looked after herself very at all. I mean, basically her diet was cheap wine, night train, and so she got ill quite quickly and died within, 9 months.
I'm sure you still go on Broadway for various things. Does the street look very different to you than it did before you started your book?
Well, it's extraordinary. I mean, when I started off walking, Broadway seemed to me eternal. It changes each generation, it changes. But the idea of a time when there wouldn't be a Broadway or when Broadway would cease to mean anything special, it never occurred to me. But as I began to walk, I realized that it was actually city policy to sell off huge chunks of real estate, which would then be turned into office blocks and lobotomats. And so the character Broadway was under threat. And in the last 5 years, Times Square, the Times Square I know and knew, has virtually disappeared. And half the sort of locations at which I'm talked to people and got to know people are now shut and boarded. So it turned into an obituary without being designed as such.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Nick Cohn. His new book about Broadway is called The Heart of the World. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Nick Cohn is my guest. His new book, The Heart of the World, is about Broadway in Manhattan. Let me ask you about the article that you're probably best known for in America. It was called Tribal Rights of the New Saturday Night. It was the article that Saturday Night Fever was based on. You wrote it for New York Magazine in June of 76. Everyone, I think, should remember the story. I was set in a disco. It was about somebody coming of age in Brooklyn, and, you know, he's kind of like the king of the disco on Saturday nights. For the rest of the week, he works in a paint store and doesn't much like the work. How did you come about writing the story?
Well, I came to America in 75, and I grew up in Ireland, and I then went to London in the what's now known as the swinging 60s, and I'd seen the Mods in Shepherd's Bush, and which was the beginning of the whole mod movement in London. And when I came to America and I started to be taken around by various people to discos and so on, I could see the same kind of obsessions that I'd seen in London in the 60s, the absolute fixation on the weekend, on clothes, and on dancing, and also on the negative side, the same complete male-dominated world in which women were treated absolutely just as props. And this interested me.
Now, you've said that this article, which was printed as a piece of journalism, as a fact piece, was actually fiction. Did your editor know this?
I didn't really have an editor. I don't know. I don't think it really came up.
How could you not have had an editor? I mean, there had to be an editor.
Well, yes, there must have been. Let me think about this carefully. No, I think that the editor probably thought that there was a Tony Manero.
So you didn't think it was your responsibility to tell him that it was a fiction piece?
In those days, I was probably very irresponsible. And no, I didn't particularly... I didn't think about it. I didn't think it through. It didn't seem at that point tremendously damaging. I felt that there was a reality to the story, emotional reality, as indeed, people from Brooklyn who I showed it to felt there was. But I didn't think that was the important thing. Whether it was what seemed important to me was it real rather than was it true?
The Saturday Night Fever story was about a disco scene. You were in England during what we in America think of as the British invasion period.
That's right, yes.
So what was the scene that you were a part of when you moved to London?
Well, that was the time when all the rock groups, which later became the major rock groups, were just starting. The Who were still called the High Numbers. the Rolling Stones had probably produced two singles or something. You could still hear these bands in clubs, and so it was, everything was just starting. And there was an extraordinary feeling. I mean, I was 17, I think, when I went to London, that anything was possible. Suddenly, 45-year-old editors, publishers, record producers were scared to turn you down in case you might, you know, they might turn around and they'd let the Beatles go. I think the most important thing that happened in England was that the Beatles were turned down by Decca Records. And everybody from then on in positions of power were terrified they'd do the same thing. So in other words, one had carte blanche. The same people who would have kicked you out the door if you'd asked for a job in 1963, by 1965 couldn't wait to get you in there fast enough.
So how did you take advantage of that?
Well, I left school at 15. I had no education whatsoever. I walked into a newspaper called The Observer, which is a national Sunday paper, and they gave me a job, which they certainly wouldn't have done a year or two before.
Writing about rock?
Really my subject was sort of street culture, always, and that included rock, and I wrote quite a bit about rock music, but only for a couple of years. It's funny, very odd now to still find myself in some reviews referred to as rock journalist. Well, I didn't actually make my living, I haven't made my living as a rock journalist since 1968. But once you get that label on you, it's yours for life, I suppose.
You were very passionate about rock during that period, weren't you?
I was very passionate about it for about 3 or 4 years. But I always felt that it was something for the very young. And really, after I got past 21, I began to think, you're hanging on a bit. And when I was 22, I wrote a book called Bop Bop A Loo Bop A Lap Bam Boom, which was the first history of rock. And that was really my farewell to the business.
You've said before that you've really disliked rock stars who present themselves as working class heroes. And I guess just in the context of that, I was wondering if you felt at all that you were slumming during your Broadway period.
No, because I felt that these people that I was talking to were teaching me a lot more than I was teaching them. In fact, I wasn't teaching them at all in most cases. There was a phrase that kept haunting me all through the book. It sounds rather pretentious to say, but there's a book, a 17th century book, called The Anatomy of Melancholy by Robert Burton. At one point in it, he's looking through some letters, but it's equivalent of looking in the morning paper. And in a sort of tumultuous sentence, he says, you know, I see these reports of murders, of famines, and I see one man rising in the world, one ruined, one marriage happy, one man. And he goes through all the events of the day, and then with a dash, he says, the misery and the gallantry of the world. Well, the misery of some elements of Broadway, that's very obvious, but the gallantry, that's what attracted me. And the people that appear in the book are people that I think, even though they might not be sort of pillars of the community from the normal capitalist point of view, they, all of them, have tremendous courage, sense of style, and they made a life. So far from slumming, in the majority of cases, I felt, you know, quite privileged to know them.
Nick Cohn's new book about Broadway is called The Heart of the World. It's published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air.